Welcome to Insight, live at noon with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. California is home to the largest population of Native Americans in the country, but it also has one of the highest rates of murdered and missing indigenous people. Ahead on Insight, the chairman of the Wilton Rancheria tribe talks about a new partnership with the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department that aims to combat the MMIP epidemic. Also, we continue our conversations with the leading candidates in the race for Sacramento mayor. Epidemiologist Dr. Flojan Kofer joins us to talk about what her top priorities would be as mayor. Finally, a new exhibit at Crocker Art Museum is highlighting the work of Black artists during a pivotal time in U.S. history. And we'll learn about a unique and local poetic twist. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Insight. But first, here's the news. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. California is home to the largest population of Native Americans in the country, as well as the most tribes. A tragic reality, however, is that we also have the fifth largest caseload of missing and murdered indigenous people in the country as well. Tribal leaders for years have called this a long-neglected crisis, an epidemic, and have struggled to find solutions and bring attention to this issue. But that awareness has been changing in a positive direction in recent years. This week, for the second year in a row, the Wilton Rancheria and Yurok tribes held the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Peoples Summit here in Sacramento. Tribal leaders from across California met with state and federal leaders to raise awareness and also to find resources to combat the MMIP epidemic. One of the actionable items that came out of this week's summit was a new partnership between Wilton Rancheria and the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department. Joining us to explain more is Jesus Tarango, chairman of the Wilton Rancheria tribe. Welcome back to Insight, Chairman Tarango.
Good morning. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here this morning with you guys. So thanks for having me back.
Thank you for taking the time. I know this week was a big one. You had a 2-day long summit. It took place at the convention center, also on the west steps of the Capitol. Senator Alex Padilla, among other elected leaders, were present. How did this second year go?
I think it went very well. I think for anything that people do, you always want to improve and add some things to the next event. And I think our second round, it was definitely bigger, I think, and struck home a little bit more, I think, to some of the people that came out. But it definitely was bigger, and we hope that we continue to grow as the years go on.
What does it mean that this is now an annual summit? This is the second year that this took place. For this to become a reality took a tremendous amount of work, I would imagine. What does it represent that this summit is now continuing 1 year after the next?
I think it shows that the community now wants, they want more involvement. And I think for decades now, our brothers and sisters to the north, the Yurok people, they've led this fight for a long, long time, advocating for it and trying to do what they can. And so for me, it's a beautiful thing to see it, because I think it shows now that people want more information, and advocacy is a beautiful thing. But I think now, you know, we got to get back into the weeds and really try to find out how we combat that. You know, we need all our players out there, but it makes me feel good to see the amount of people that took the time out of their day to come hear about a crisis that's not only affecting our state, but many states across the United States here.
We've had the Yurok tribe on to talk about the MMIP crisis, and this tribe is among the largest in the state. They're located in the northwest corner of California, which is very rural. When learning about, you know, Wilton Rancheria's involvement, I mean, you're located here at home in Sacramento, and in your press release, it said that indigenous people go missing and are murdered at higher rates in California and here in Sacramento County than almost anywhere else in the country. I think that may come as a surprise to people learning about that this is taking place here in Sacramento. What would you like people to know?
Well, I would like people to know that, you know, we're all tribes are different, right? I think people sometimes think that this should be a one-all fix-all for our people here, but we're very different. We're different from our brothers and sisters up north who are in a little bit more rural area. But my people here in the city, we experience the same things. And here, California, we have the fifth largest amount of of disappearances and things of that nature. But yes, absolutely. Our people, our women and girls, 4 out of 5 of our women and girls are going to experience some type of violence or abuse in their time. You know, one of the staggering statistics that I like to bring up, or not like to bring up, but it at least gets people to understand, my nation is about 1,000 strong. And if we look at the statistics of that, that breaks it down to about 483 women in my tribe. And so of my 483 women, 387 of them are going to suffer some form of violence, sexual abuse, or ultimately may go missing and murdered. And so for that, you know, we really want to show people that it's not just in one area. This affects our entire state. And I think that's why you saw us do what we did with our local sheriff here in saying that I think it's time that we want to jump into the fight and help lead that with our brothers and sisters here in our state. Hmm.
What are the barriers when it comes to investigating and solving these cases? I mean, I would imagine there are complexities.
Absolutely. Here in California, we're a PL 280 state, and you're really talking about jurisdiction. And in some of these cases with some of these tribes, the law enforcement doesn't know their obligations to the tribes, you know, and sometimes the tribes don't know, you know, what they should be asking for, or what they should be not asking for, but we should be demanding what is ours and what's right for us. But you also have to remember there's 58 counties in California. And so with those 58 counties, I think it's really up to the tribes as well to establish those relationships with their sheriff's department, because you have to come and meet in the middle, I think, for us to really combat this. And so that kind of throws a little, you know, wrench in that for us. But again, here, you know, with us here in this area, really, really wanted to establish a relationship with our sheriff here, with Jim Cooper, and really hopefully use us as an example to other tribes. You know, Yurok, they do it in a way up there where, you know, we're hopeful to go up there and learn what they do and how they do it, and then bring it back down here and kind of, you know, mold it to what will work for us. I think that's really the end goal for all of us here, is to just really focus on our own communities and see what we can do, and then come together and go after some legislation that I think will give us the tools that we need.
Well, let's get into that partnership. This week, part of that summit, Wilton Rancheria and the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department, as you mentioned, you finalized a memorandum of agreement. What does this entail?
You know, I want to just say, I think that, you know, we don't know. But the beautiful thing about this is, I think that for tribes and anything that we do, things really need to be tribally led. And what I mean by that is that, you know, people really have to hear what the tribes' needs are, because our needs aren't the same. Again, there's 109 federally recognized tribes in California, but we all have different, our rights are different, our sovereignty, your constitution, it's really different. And so for us, we really wanted to just work with our county. And so with that, you know, the framework really is just for cooperation and collaboration between the tribe and our sheriff of matters that really relate to our public safety. You know, again, we hope that with this, we're going to go out. Our plan is to go up to the Yurok country, go up north and work with them up there, and kind of just, you know, maybe just watch. You know, I tell people all the time, Creator gave us 2 eyes and 2 ears for a reason. And so I think for us, we're going to really go down this slowly and observing everything that works for them, and trying to figure out how we can make it come back down here and work for us. You know, I definitely see it as a bonus as well, being the capital tribe here in this great state. I think that anything that we do with our local sheriff, maybe the legislatures and the people that make the laws for us here in this state, they'll read about it, and maybe it'll be on their radar a little bit more, and they'll be more inclined to listen to what the tribes are saying so that we can help our state.
Right. Like, that could translate to political will. When talking with tribes about just this specific issue, and I think of the Yurok tribe, you know, there has been a historical distrust of law enforcement, you know, over generations. Wilton Rancheria and the collaboration with Sheriff Jim Cooper, there is a backstory here. Cooper was the former mayor of Elk Grove, which is located where your tribe is located. Do you think that served as an advantage to overcome that barrier of distrust and broker these relationships?
I think it's a perfect example of what we need, and what on both sides of the road, I would say. You said it just that, with how you opened up. There's a mistrust, and you're absolutely right. You got to remember that our people have been here since time immemorial, and so for every bit of law enforcement or any agency that has come to our reservations or rancherias here. It started hundreds of years ago when people would come into our reservations and rancherias and take our children or take people away from us. So there is that distrust there with law enforcement or any of those other agencies. And so the idea is that who knows the tribes best than the tribes? And again, with us having Jim Cooper, as he was the first mayor of Elk Grove, he was an assembly member, championed a lot of things for the tribe. We already have that trust built with him. And I think that he knows his area, he knows his region. And that's so big when you're talking about the crisis that we're wanting to engage in. That trust has to be there. When people are going to the rancheries and reservations and they're asking for information, the citizens might not be so quick to share information. You know, you got to remember, we're multi-generational, right? A lot of our people. And so what law enforcement means to maybe some of our grandparents, you know, it was a different story for them. And so there's, you learn these things, I would say. And so that's the beauty in our MOA, and that we hope that people can look at what we're doing here and again, take it back to their homes and figure it out. But I really believe that you have to have that trust has to be built. And I think we have an advantage because we do have a lot of trust with our current sheriff. But again, he knows his region and he knows the area. And I think that's very helpful.
When it comes to a tribe's sovereignty, and specifically with Wilton Rancheria, if people are unfamiliar, when it comes to your tribe's history, I mean, if I remember correctly, you're among one of the newest federally recognized tribes. I mean, I think this was back in 2013. I mean, your tribe had to fight very hard for years to make this happen. What would you like listeners to know about Wilton Rancheria?
I think Wilton Rancheria is just like any other tribe here. We're unique, but I think people forget sometimes our people, the native people, we were often characterized as the silent ones, the silent people. We're nice and we don't fight for things. You know, I beg to differ. You know, I think what I want people to know is that our people have been fighting since the colonizers came. We've had to fight for simple things. You know, we just barely got our rights to practice our own religion, you know, last century, you know, and so things of that nature, you know, we're here. We definitely know it's a tough battle. But Wilton Rancheria was established in 1928. We were terminated in 1958 or 59. And it took us 50 years to gain our federal recognition back. So we did gain our recognition back in 2009. And we've been up and running now for the last, 13, 14 years. But I think I'd like people to know that our people are resilient people, you know, and stuff like this, we're going to protect our people. And I think that's why you see us going out there and trying to form these relationships with our local agencies.
Chairman Tarongo, thank you so much for the time.
Oh, thank you. And I hope that we see more people next year at our third MMIP. But again, I would tell any of your listeners, if they want to get engaged with that, look into their local tribes and find out how they could help, because MMIP is just not a crisis in Indian Country. It's a crisis throughout our state. So I would definitely look there.
Jesus Tarongo is the chairman of the Wilton Rancheria tribe, discussing the MMIP epidemic that has murdered and missing Indigenous people in Sacramento County and a new collaboration with the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. In the month leading up to the primary, there are some big decisions that Sacramento voters will have to make. The city will be electing a new mayor. And this month, we're sitting down with the four leading candidates. Former Sacramento City Council member Steve Hansen joined us last week. There's also former State Senator Dr. Richard Pan and current State Assembly member Kevin McCarty. Today, though, we are welcomed by epidemiologist and public health professional Dr. Flojan Kofor about why she's the best fit to lead Sacramento and her top priorities for the city if elected mayor. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Okay, so you would be new to elected office if you're elected as mayor, but you have worked in Sacramento in multiple capacities in advisory roles, from Sacramento's Active Transportation Commission with the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department for Outreach and Community Advisory, the Mayor's Commission on Climate Change, Measure U, as well as an advisory committee member. Where did your dedication for public service in this capacity, where did it come from?
Honestly, it came from my parents. You know, they were both public school teachers, and I always say that they taught me that community really cares about one another. So if you lived in our neighborhood and you wanted to go to college, even if you didn't know my parents, you would just ring the doorbell in the afternoon, like in the fall or the summer, and you would say, hey, I want to apply to college, and they would sit you down at our dining room table and start working with you on your essays. And on the way out the door, they would be saying, like, don't forget to have your parents or grandparents or aunts or uncles call me about, you know, assistance with the FAFSA form, and, you know, really making sure that financial aid was accessible. It was a full service thing. But I also went through this, like, kind of snarky phase early on where I saw problems and I would say things like, somebody should do something about that. And my parents would march me into the mirror and say it again in the mirror, because you're somebody and you should. You don't get to abdicate responsibility or make it seem as if other people should handle something. You have a responsibility. And so what are you going to do about the problems that you're seeing and the challenges that we're facing?
Your background is in public health. You're an epidemiologist, and that really looks at the determinants of health and diseases within a community. How did that transition to wanting to be in elected office, running for mayor?
Honestly, you know, it started when I came to California almost 20 years ago, and I was, you know, working at the Department of Public Health. And one of my first, you know, responsibilities in my job after my fellowship was to look at the Affordable Care Act and to send testimony to for what should be included in the preventive services. And I wrote up the section on including birth control with no copay. And when it was included, I was like, oh my goodness, this is huge, because I came to the Department of Public Health as a fellow and I not only didn't have health insurance, but I had to buy it on the private market, and the plan I could afford didn't include birth control. So I had to purchase it out of pocket. And so it was a full circle moment for me, but it also reminded me that, you know, epidemiology is about understanding how things are connected and what those determinants of health are. But there's also a real role for translating what we know into what we do. And I think that was really the first foray into, wow, policy really can change people's lives. And I'd like to be a part of that.
Was there a specific issue or perhaps flashpoint in the city of Sacramento and you working with the city where you were dissatisfied, perhaps, and you felt like, I need to run for mayor?
It started when I was on the Measure U Community Advisory Committee, in part because there were so many opportunities. It was really my time to
see. And
that
was a sales tax increase that voters approved.
Yes, that happened in 2018. It was set to expire. It was a half-cent sales tax. And the mayor and council put it on the ballot to be doubled and to be permanent. And so my first, you know, push was with community members to say, we need a real advisory committee for it. And then I could hear my parents in the back of my head saying, you're somebody, you should. So when it came time to apply to be on it, I felt we shouldn't just advocate for it to exist and not participate. So I applied and I ended up being the chair for four terms. And I was frustrated because voters were promised that those dollars were going to be spent primarily on three things: inclusive economic development, affordable housing and homelessness, and the arts community. And the dollars weren't spent that way. So we were really pushing for honor the promises that you made to voters when this was put on the ballot. And then we started saying, okay, well, what are the opportunities to be able to fit into what the city's already doing? And so we were looking at things like the process and efficiency recommendations that we paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for. There were 39 of them, and largely didn't implement. And that could have saved us the dollars that now we're having this conversation about the deficit. There's at least $50 million a year in savings in those recommendations that if we had implemented them 4 years ago, not only would we not be in a deficit, but we'd probably have $150 million extra dollars at our disposal.
So if you are elected mayor, day one, what is your first priority?
well, moving into the office and getting some good local art up on the wall. but really, you know, my first two priorities are to make sure that how we govern reflects the needs of Sacramento. So first and foremost, our city needs some goals. We need to be able to say, this is what we're going to do. I have been talking publicly about we are the capital of the fourth largest economy on planet Earth. And it is unacceptable to me that we have 1,500 kids and families with children sleeping on our streets. And so by the end of my first term, I want that to change. And that's going to require us to collaborate with our business community and our nonprofits and our neighborhood associations and the 30,000 people who wake up early on Thanksgiving to do Run to Feed the Hungry to support the food bank. It's going to take all of us to be able to do that. But once we have a goal, I literally see the wheels start moving in people's heads about how they can fit into making goals happen. And so I think it is the responsibility of our mayor to put on the agenda, what are the priorities? So our city staff know what they're working towards and are not constantly in crisis mode and, you know, changing week to week, that they know this is what we're working on for the next 2 years until the next election. And here are our annual goals. So we know what we're working towards to be successful. So that's step one. And then I think step two is, how do we get more community involved? Voices involved in the process. Because whether I'm in East Sacramento and Land Park or I'm in Meadowview or Del Paso Heights, what I hear from everyone is we are brought in on decisions too late and only after the fact. And I don't want that to be the case anymore. We don't have to only use 5 days advance notice to talk about things. And so I'd love to have a process that's much more like the state, where the mayor and the council and our department chairs have an opportunity to introduce policies, and then they go to our boards, committees, and commissions for advice, for review, that our neighborhood associations get an opportunity to weigh in and say, we support this, or here's how you could amend it, long before it comes back to the council for a vote. And I think if we streamline and organize our decision making in a way that actually respects the people who live in Sacramento, we can get better outcomes, we'll get less pushback, and we'll have an opportunity to be able to, you know, avoid some of the challenges and hurdles that some of our previous proposals have you know, had encountered on their way, in part because people are frustrated by how you do things. My parents always said, it's not always what you do, it's how you do it. And I think that's incredibly important when it comes to governance.
Well, I think one of the biggest examples of this is arguably the biggest issue that Sacramento faces, and that is homelessness, people who are housing insecure or are unsheltered. I mean, this is something that Mayor Steinberg, since he was first elected, I mean, this was an issue that he wanted to tackle. There are many elected officials currently across the aisle that will say kind of the same reasons. It's a mental health issue. It is an affordable housing issue. But I think everyday residents don't necessarily feel like, despite the unprecedented investment in money, that their neighborhoods are better, you know, and that this issue is getting resolved. And numbers would also confirm that as well. What could you do differently as mayor that would alleviate conditions for those who are unsheltered or housing insecure, you know, once you take office within your first year, within your first 6 months?
Yeah, well, step one is that at the end of this year, our insufficient rent stabilization policy is going to expire. And that's the one that says basically that rents can go up 10% per year. And so the folks that I'm running against think that's sufficient, and that's, they want to just continue it and that's it. When I talk to people, they tell me their rents are too high, and that even when they started out being able to afford their apartments in a few years, that 10% increase that's not accompanied by a 10% increase in their income is making it so it's hard to afford housing. So I'd like to start there. I think we can have real rent control in the city of Sacramento, and that's something that I really want as that policy is set to expire for us to push for, because it's something across the board that people in Sacramento are saying is a real problem and is contributing to us going from 3,900 people experiencing homelessness in 2019 to now 10,000. And so we really need to be able to crack down on that. But even more important than that, you know, every day I talk to people who say, I am so heartbroken by seeing people outside without their basic needs met. And so we need safe ground. We need places where people can do laundry and use the bathroom and have a shower and charge their cell phones and have some shelter from the elements. And we need to set those up quickly. And I know that there has been pushback about where those sites should be, and they need to be distributed across the city of Sacramento. And there should be trash pickup, and there should be, you know, good neighbor policies that are established in advance so that we all know what to expect and how we're going to engage with one another so that we're not creating blight or harming our communities. And part of that is having those conversations up front. And why I'm excited to be running for mayor is that the mayor here has the benefit of having 15 staff people. So we are better equipped than any of our city council members to really be able to do that community engagement. And that's one of the things that I'm running my campaign like this. This is a people-powered campaign with people all across the region being involved. And that is how we are going to govern as well. Having community conversations, not imposing our will on people, but bringing them in early into the conversations, viewing them as partners, not just as obstacles to navigate around.
And that, I mean, one of the issues that you brought up and possible solutions is something that Mayor Steinberg argued for as well, that this should be shouldered by every district in the city. But when it comes to the city of Sacramento, the mayor is just one vote.
Yes.
And so you do have more staff, but you still have to work with your council members to get your initiatives, your policies across the finish line. And
Absolutely.
You would be the face of the city, but you are one vote. How would you work with council members who are also responsible for their own constituents and when you perhaps disagree about the best solutions to move forward?
Well, you know, one of the things about being a public health professional that I think best equips me to handle this is, look, every time public health has an idea, everybody hates it. We know that's part of the process. So we're not intimidated by the chaos of when we introduce something, people say no. When we first introduced seatbelts, people called us tyrants and said that this is un-American and that we are infringing upon their freedoms. And so we had to listen through that and still participate in the ways that humans do you know, change and accept change. And so that's what I'm bringing to the table is I'm going to work with every single council member in every single district to make sure that we are engaging with the people who live there up front in advance, not after we've made a decision and people are angry about it, but making them part of the process. Because what we know is that success has many parents and failure is abandoned. We know that when people feel like they're being imposed upon, they will oppose you, even if it's something that they kind of agree with. But when you bring them in from the front and you make it partly their idea and it's their success to have, they will help spur the success. They will help you to figure out ways to be able to get other people on board, to be able to combat some of the challenges you're facing. And so that's really where the partnership with each and every council member will come into place. We're going to listen to communities. We're going to bring them in meaningful ways. We're going to talk to the people who are most impacted, and we're going to come up with solutions together. And I think that's the major distinction between me and the other people who are running, is that I have experience doing that. I'm running a campaign that is setting us up for that type of success and engagement. And I'm looking forward to actually governing. I'm looking forward to people yelling at us and saying no up front and us saying, no is the least interesting thing about what you said. Why? And once we get to the why is I'm concerned about safety in my community. I don't want there to be needles and trash strewn about. I want, like, those are things we can address. Your no is actually the least interesting thing about your position. I really want to understand why you're there and what we can do to be able to alleviate those concerns, because your no is only predicated on your why.
That also involves partnerships not only with city council members, also the county. I mean, there is, on paper, a partnership between the city and the county, but it has been challenged in recent years. And even, you know, within the last year with the new district attorney, there are lawsuits as well stemming from encampments. How would you overcome these hurdles? Because you would inherit this relationship to work in tandem with the county.
Well, the beautiful thing is that right now in my day job, which I'm on leave from, you know, until the election, but we are actually the technical assistance provider for the county for the community health improvement plan. And so I have good relationships with the county. We work with them constantly. And what I know is that there are plans already in place, our local homeless action plans, about stabilizing people who are in imminent risk of homelessness, about, you know, addressing some of the long-term needs when it comes to affordable housing. And so what I want to do is take us from just having the collaboration being mostly relational to it actually having outcomes that we are both responsible for. And one of the things that I've already started having conversations with our supervisors about is having joint meetings, because there's more than just homelessness that we need to coordinate on. And having all five of the supervisors and all nine of the members of the city council on the dais at the same time, actually allocating, you know, resources and also passing policy together, eliminates that need for a game of tag. You can still have smaller groups of people do the planning, but when it comes to making the decisions, we should be doing it together and we should be hearing, because we are overlapping in our jurisdictions and we need to work together in a very practical sense. And that also needs to have some transparency with our communities.
Another priority of yours is public safety. You know, and some would also use the word crime. And language is important. Choice of words is important. And you lead with public safety versus crime. Why is that lens important?
Well, first of all, public safety is about the feeling of being able to move through your community without being worried about being harmed. And as the only woman in this race, as a Black woman, and as someone who, you know, frequently has to navigate the world, you know, by myself, I am very concerned with public safety. But what I understand is that none of us wake up in the morning hoping to call 911. And so when we only invest our dollars in response, we don't have the opportunity to actually invest in prevention. And what I've seen in Sacramento is that we went 2 years with no youth homicides, with no young people hanging RIP banners on the fences of their
high schools. Before 2020.
Right. 2017 to 2020 was actually over 2 years, right? And then just as the drivers of violence were going up, we kind of disbanded that network and stopped doing what we were doing that made us successful. And unfortunately, in public health, this happens to us a lot. We are victims of our own success. And when we do something well, then people start saying, do we need to continue doing it? Yes, we do. And so I'm really invested in having a public safety department that includes emergency response, but that is not only limited to emergency response, and also making sure that the response is correct. Because if your house is on fire, you certainly don't want somebody coming along who's a mental health professional. You want the fire department to show up and to extinguish the fire. And so I want to make sure that the response matches the need. And that's part of what analyzing our 911 data in conjunction with UC Davis will allow us to do, to be able to figure out how do we have an emergency response and a public safety department that is meeting the needs of 2024, not 1960 when it was set up.
You know, also in your language and how you describe public safety on your campaign page, you know, there wasn't mention of Sacramento police specifically. I mean, you do mention emergency response. And I know that you've been on an advisory board with the Sacramento County Sheriff's Office, so you do have involvement with law enforcement. How do you view law enforcement in our community? What do they do right? Because ultimately, you would need to work with Chief Kathy Lester and the department if elected mayor.
Yeah, I worked with Chief Lester when she was Deputy Chief Lester under Chief Hahn on the heat table with Sacramento Act, which is hiring, equipment, accountability, and training. And part of that was really looking from a community-based lens on how is our department operating. And I've been really, you know, quite frankly, disappointed in, you know, some of the pushback that we've gotten from our department about the Fourth Amendment violations, about some of the ways that we engage in accountability. And here's why. Any healthy organization should be able to handle criticism and should be eager to be able to make changes so that they can work better. And I was really appreciative of the way that Chief Lester laid out what public safety is and how the police department can't do it by itself. But that also needs to be coupled with a culture change in understanding how we're engaging with communities. When I look at stats that say Black men make up 5% of the population in Sacramento, 40% of the stops, and 82%, the highest percentage, result in no citation, that means that every time you're stopping those people who are in that 82% and you don't issue a citation, you were harassing them and you were wasting precious dollars. And I work hard for my money, and I think most people in Sacramento do. And so we want you to be doing things that are actually contributing to safety, not harassing people and eroding trust. And so part of what I want us to do is to look to people like Dr. Letitia Watson, who's our Office of Public Safety Accountability Director, who is saying, who's a former police chief and a national expert, and is saying, we're not following national protocols on how we engage with communities from the perspective of policing. That's what I want to see happen, and that's the role of police. I want them to move away, like Los Angeles Police Union has proposed, which is the largest union in the state. They've identified 28 call types that uniformed officers should not be responding to that are better suited for someone else. That's what I want our department to be looking at and saying, how can we best participate in a public safety, you know, initiative, and not just owning things that we're not equipped for and that we don't need? Because if we are able to do that, then our police department can actually focus on solving crime, can focus on the things that people are saying they want them to do, can increase their response times because you have the same number of people, but they're actually working efficiently instead of just being spread thin and not doing what works and keeps us safe.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with epidemiologist and public health professional Dr. Flojan Kofer, who is running for Sacramento mayor. We only have a few minutes left, and I'm curious. Mayor Daryl Steinberg is rounding out his second term. How do you think he was as mayor?
I think, you know, Mayor Steinberg came in with having had a lot of wins at the state level and really being ambitious about what he could do at the local level. But I think, you know, the challenge, and I'm going to quote Neil deGrasse, or I'm going to paraphrase Neil deGrasse Tyson here about, like, too often we have attorneys and people with sort of the same backgrounds who are engaging in public service. And he says, where are the teachers? Where are the construction workers? Where are the public health professionals? Where are the scientists? Where are other people who have a different lens? And so what I would say is what works at the state level doesn't always translate to what works at the local level. You have to be deeply embedded in these communities. You have to be willing to listen to people. You have to recognize that, you know, yes, you're the mayor, but you don't always have to be the person who owns something or is putting forward the initiative. And we need to take the time to be able to push things forward. And I actually think some of the things that were happening at the state level, if we had brought them to the local level, like the process of introducing legislation so people have time to weigh in, would have possibly made things like the Department of Community Response, which I actually think is his best initiative since he's been on the council, much more of a success because people would have been involved in them. And so I actually have the benefit of learning from the things that he experimented with. And being the person who comes before you is, you know, that's the hard part, right? You're trying to do something different in the face of new challenges. But what I would say is, you know, I think his intentions were good on a lot of things. He comes with a mental health background and some of the things that he certainly did, the MHSA, Mental Health Services Act, the Millionaire's Tax at the state level, seeded programs that I've directed. Right. So I appreciate those things. And also I have the benefit of hindsight, and hindsight is 2020, to be able to see what didn't work and how I can take those lessons and apply them to the next administration. And I'm really looking forward to coming in and having success based on those lessons learned and also being the model for somebody else to come in and say, hey, here's what Flo wasn't able to do. And I'll pick up the baton and do that next.
A big hurdle, a big challenge that you're going to inherit comes down to money, funding, and you touched upon this. The city is facing like an estimated $50 million budget deficit, and that doesn't mean it's only going to be reserved to the upcoming fiscal year. How will you prioritize spending for essential city services?
Yeah, first and foremost, I want us to look at how we're spending money and is it efficient? Because, again, looking at those process and efficiency recommendations, we have at least $50 million in proposed savings that if we had done that 4 years ago, we would be in a much better position. And so I'm always going to look at how do we work smarter and not harder. And then next, I'm going to be looking at what are the other opportunities for revenue generation? That's one of the core principles that's right there on page 48 of our budget, is how we are supposed to be budgeting in community, at the guidance of people who live here, and also thinking about revenue. And part of that is also benefiting our partnerships. How are we working with our business community? How are we working with our nonprofits? Not just as funders, but also as key partners. How are we mobilizing the people who live here, who care about this community and want to help? And so I'm going to be looking at ways that we can be efficient in how we do things, how we partner, and how we get to our goals. And that's going to be, I think, a real shift in terms of the role that we see our government playing, which is exactly the role of, you know, the narrative change maker in the mayor's office.
Finally, if you are elected, you would become the first Black woman to serve as mayor of Sacramento. Is that more than a milestone for you?
It certainly is a milestone. And, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about my earrings and my choice of colors that I wear and how, you know, I show up in the world. And I think part of what is historic about it is that I have the opportunity to reshape for an entire generation and generations to come what a professional looks like, what a mayor looks like and sounds like, and what that experience is. And so I don't take that lightly. Being a Black woman is not the most interesting thing about me, but it is an interesting thing about me. It is unique, and I think it offers a lot of opportunity for women to be able to see themselves, for Black girls to be able to see themselves, for people who don't show up in standard ways to be able to see themselves and having a role in governance. And I'm excited about all the dividends that will yield in our ability to pass policy, to bring new voices to the table, and to really create long-term and sustainable change.
Dr. Kofer, thank you for the time.
Thank you for having me.
And that is epidemiologist, public health professional, Dr. Flojean Kofer, who is running for Sacramento mayor. We spoke with former city council member Steve Hansen last week. Next week, we welcome state assembly member Kevin McCarty, and former state senator Richard Pan will round out our conversations with the leading mayoral candidates. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. We'll be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. A new exhibit recently opened at the Crocker Art Museum in downtown Sacramento. It's called Black Artists in America, From Civil Rights to the Bicentennial. The exhibit captures the powerful works of Black artists at a critical moment in American history across the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And it also features local reflections and work courtesy of Sacramento area students. Joining us now for a closer look at the exhibit, which runs through May, is Dr. Francesca Wilmot, the curator at the Crocker Art Museum. Good afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
So there is a backstory to this traveling exhibit. Can you share with us what brought Black artists in America to the Crocker?
Absolutely. So this exhibition was curated by Dr. Ernestine Lavelle Jenkins, and it traveled to us from the Dixon Gallery and Gardens in Memphis, Tennessee. And it's actually the second iteration of a three-part exhibition series that they're doing focused on Black artists in America. So the first iteration opened during COVID, and so unfortunately it was unable to travel. And so we are the beneficiaries of the second version of this show.
I had the Crocker on during the pandemic, just explaining, I mean, all the wheels that have to align to get exhibits and to the Crocker as well as other museums, and that the pandemic really threw a kink in scheduling, you know, because these are traveling exhibits. For people who are going to be taking this in, I know that you couldn't do it during the pandemic, of course. This is a second installation. What can they expect?
So the exhibition includes 60 brilliant and powerful works made by the leading artists in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Many of those artists are well-known names. They received attention during their lifetimes. Others are recent rediscoveries, artists who are left out of history. And so I think when you visit the exhibition, one of the big takeaways is just how diverse the range of creativity is. There's abstraction, there's figuration, there's political protest art. There's really a wide range of artistic expression on view.
And it's not just visual art, correct?
That's right. So we do have a vinyl record in the show as well. And so one of my goals with the exhibition was to demonstrate that the artists were not just, you know, making paintings and sculptures and drawings, but their creative practices transcended the canvas. They were poets, they were musicians, they were politically engaged, writing plays, really using whatever means they had available to communicate their message.
You mentioned that this exhibit comes from Memphis, Tennessee, but there is a really great local addition at the Crocker Art Museum, and we're going to listen to some Sacramento area youth who shared some poems. Before we dive into that, how did that come about?
Yes, so the Crocker has a long and fruitful partnership with the Sojourner Truth African Heritage Museum here in Sacramento and with the founding director, Shona McDaniels. And so when we were working on this exhibition, we met with Shona to think through some ways that we could make the exhibition relevant locally and really spotlight youth in our community through the show. And so with Shona's help and coordination, we were able to include poetic responses for almost every work in the show by students locally.
Oh, that's wonderful. Tell us a little bit about the students. What are their age ranges?
So they range in age from 7 to 23 years old, and they are at all different schools across Sacramento. Even a few students from Georgia and Florida slipped into the mix. So it's really fun to see how they responded to the works on view.
We're going to listen to some of them right now. The first one we're going to listen to is Naz Muhammad, 16 years old and is homeschooled here in Sacramento. And the poem was inspired by the Merton D. Simpson piece, Confrontation.
This poem is inspired by the Merton D. Simpson art piece titled Confrontation. He was only 15, just a year younger than me, shot dead in the streets, killed by an officer of the police. Oh, and he was off duty. Why are you carrying a gun, sir? You hung up your hat and took off your shirt. I would say you were done with your day's work. People on the fence don't know which side to be on. Black and white. No, wrong and right. Because James Powell was just a kid even if he had a knife. The officer had no real cause to draw his gun. I guess he was trigger happy playing target practice when he sees black boys run. People everywhere. And riot ensues. No one gave a care. It was blacks against the NYPD blues. Systematically, we've been profiled. When will it ever end? The time is right now, so we all can win.
And that is 16-year-old Naz Muhammad. Where is his work going to be at the exhibit?
Yeah, so this work is paired with a work by John Biggers called The Man. And it's, when you enter the gallery, it's kind of in the back right corner in a very quiet, contemplative niche. And I thought that it was important to place these works kind of in this quieter space because of such a powerful message that they convey.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to listen to the powerful work. The next one we're going to listen to is Nasara McDaniels Keys, 19 years old, from Sacramento City College.
Nasara McDaniels Keys, in the title of this poem is Sarah. In the depths of history pages, a tale of strength and courage rages. Black women, warriors bold and true, and daring struggle and breaking through. From the days of slavery chains, their spirit rose above the pain. With heart afire, they fought the fight for freedom dawn. They shone so bright. Through the fields of cotton, they toiled long. Their voices silent, but not for long. With resilience and grace, they stood tall. Their spirits unbreakable, never to fall. In the face of adversity, they found their voice, speaking truth and demanding choice. Their words like music, a powerful song, inspiring generations righting the wrongs. From civil rights to women's rights, black women fought with all their might. They broke down barriers, shattering glass ceilings. Their strength and brilliance truly revealing. In art and literature, they left their mark. Their creativity igniting a spark. Their stories and voices forever heard. Celebrating the beauty, every single word. Black women, queens of strength and grace, their presence fills every space. They are the pillars, the guiding light, uplifting others with all their might. So let's celebrate their legacy, their trumpets and their bravery. For black women, warriors, bold and true, we stand with you and we honor you.
And that is 19-year-old Nasara McDaniels Keys. You know, I've been to the Crocker Museum many, many times, but I have to say, I just love what you're doing with this and incorporating this into this exhibit.
Thank you. Yeah, the exhibition has really inspired us to take a close look at our collection. It allows us to see what the strengths are, as well as areas of oversight and gaps historically. And so the work that Nasara is responding to is a recently acquired print by Charles White. It's a print called Sarah, and it's on view with another recently acquired work by Samila Lewis in the exhibition.
Yeah, I love how it just complements. It's wonderful. The final one we're going to here from is from Kyle Hayes, 16 years old, from Elk Grove High School.
Amos and Andy poem, made by Kyle Hayes from Elk Grove High School. In strokes of courage and defiance, Donaldson's art unveils a powerful alliance. Amos and Andy, reborn anew, no longer caricatures, but heroes true. Confronting problems with weapons advanced, they stand tall, ready to take a stance. Stars transformation, a liberation's call, Aunt Jemima rises, breaking the fall. From whitewashed past to destiny's embrace, Amos and Andy reclaim their rightful place. Honoring the struggle, the revolutionary fights, Donaldson's painting brings history to light.
And that is 16-year-old Kyle Hayes, who attends Elk Grove High School. What I also love about this is that this exhibit looks to the past, right? We're looking at key moments in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But by bringing in youth of today, it really reminds us of the importance of the past to really soak in this current moment in history.
Yes, I think one of the big takeaways from the exhibition is that so many of the themes that the artists were exploring during this time period are still really relevant. Their ideas and goals that are being fought for today. And so we can see how far we've come, but also how much work is left to be done.
And the exhibit is already open. It runs through May. How has the response been? What are audiences taking away?
Yeah, we've had an incredible response. And on Sunday, February the 18th, we will be hosting our Black History Month Festival. And so we invite everybody to come back and experience it in person. It'll be a day full of poetry readings, music, live performances.
Oh, that's wonderful. So what time does it go from? Because it's this weekend.
It's this weekend. It's 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's free for all. So please come out and bring your family and your friends. It's going to be wonderful.
You mentioned that this is the second installment of Black Artists in America, and it goes from the 50s through the 70s. Will there be a third installment? Because a lot has happened since the 1970s as well.
Yes. So the Dixon Gallery is working on a third installment. It's looking at the 1980s through 9/11. So keep an eye out for that.
Wonderful. Well, Francesca, thank you so much. Anything else you want people to know about this exhibit?
Just to come on out on Sunday. We really hope to see everyone there. And thank you so much for having me.
And that is Dr. Francesca Wilmont, a curator at the Crocker Art Museum, discussing the museum's new Black Artists in America exhibit, which features local collection pieces, as well as loans from across the country and local student poetry. The exhibit runs through May. And the poets, the student youth that we heard from today were Naz Muhammad, 16 years old in Sacramento, Nasara McDaniel-Keys, 19 years old, attends Sacramento City College, and Kyle Hayes, 16 years old, and attends Elk Grove High School in Sacramento County. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or really wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to reach out to us, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our show music, you're listening to it, is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We're going to catch you back here after the holiday on Tuesday, right at noon.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.